Liberty by John Stuart Mill, first published in 1859. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 5. Applications. One would like the principles asserted in these pages to be applied consistently across all the various branches of government and morals, but there is no chance of doing that fruitfully until the principles have become more generally accepted, so that they can be the basis for a discussion of the relevant details. All I shall do here is to offer some examples of how to go about applying the principles. They may serve to clarify the meaning and the limits of the two maxims that together form the entire doctrine of this work, and to assist the judgment in holding the balance between them, in cases where it appears doubtful which of them is applicable to the case. The principles in question are these two. Firstly, the individual is not accountable to society for his actions, in so far as these concern the interests of no one but himself. Advice, instruction, persuasion, and avoidance by other people, if they think it necessary for the individual's own good, are the only measures by which society can justifiably express its dislike or disapproval of his conduct. Secondly, the individual is accountable for actions of his that harm the interests of others, and he may be subjected either to social or to legal punishment if society thinks that one or the other is needed for its protection. The first point to be made is this. Just because damage, or the probability of damage, to the interests of others, is the only thing that can justify the interference of society, it doesn't follow that it always justifies such interference. In many cases, an individual, in pursuing a legitimate object, inevitably causes pain or loss to others, or gets for himself a good that someone else had hoped to obtain. Such oppositions of interest between individuals often arise from bad social institutions, and are unavoidable while those institutions last. Others would be unavoidable under any institutions. Anyone who succeeds in an overcrowded profession, or in a competitive examination, more generally, anyone who comes ahead of someone else in any contest, benefits from his competitor's loss, wasted effort, and disappointment. But we all agree that it is better for the general interest of mankind that people should pursue their objectives undeterred by consequences of this sort. In other words, society doesn't grant disappointed competitors any legal or moral right to immunity from this kind of suffering, and feels called on to interfere in competitive situations only when someone has succeeded through fraud, treachery, or force. Again, trade is a social act. Someone who undertakes to sell goods of any kind to the public is doing something that affects the interests of other people and of society in general. So his conduct does, in principle, come within the jurisdiction of society, which is why it was once thought the duty of governments, in all cases that were thought important, to fix prices and regulate the processes of manufacture. But it is now recognized, though only after a long struggle, that the best way to get good products at low prices is to leave the producers and sellers perfectly free, as long as the buyers are free to get their supplies elsewhere. This is the so-called doctrine of free trade. The case for it is different from the case for the principle of individual liberty defended here, but it is just as solid. Restrictions on trade, or on production for purposes of trade, are indeed restraints, and restraint as such is always bad. But the restraints on trade that are in question here affect only a part of conduct that society is, in principle, entitled to restrain, and they are wrong, purely because they don't really produce the results they are meant to produce. So the principle of individual liberty is not involved in the doctrine of free trade itself, nor does it come into most of the questions that arise concerning the limits of that doctrine. For example, how much public control is admissible to prevent fraud by false labelling? How far sanitary precautions or arrangements to protect people working in dangerous occupations should be enforced on employers. Questions like these involve the liberty issue only marginally to the general thesis that leaving people to themselves is always better, other things being equal, than controlling them. It can't be denied that people may be legitimately controlled for ends such as the ones I have just mentioned. On the other hand, some questions relating to interference with trade are centrally questions of liberty, namely, cases where the object of the interference is to make it hard or impossible to obtain a particular commodity such as alcohol or opium. These interferences are objectionable as infringements on the liberty, not of the producer or seller, but of the buyer. The sale of poisons raises a new question, the question of what the proper limits are of what may be called the functions of police. How far can liberty legitimately be invaded for the prevention of crime or of accidents? It is one of the undisputed functions of government to take precautions against crime before it has been committed, as well as to detect and punish it afterwards. The preventive function of government, however, is far more liable to be abused at the expense of liberty than is its punitive function. For almost every part of the legitimate freedom of action of a human being could be represented, and fairly too, as increasing the facilities for some kind of misconduct. Someone earns his living making hammers. Now think about the crimes that can be committed using a hammer. Still, if a public authority or even a private person sees someone evidently preparing to commit a crime, they aren't bound to hold back until the crime is committed, but may interfere to prevent it. If poisons were never bought or used for any purpose except to commit murder, it would be right to prohibit their manufacture and sale. In fact, however, they may be wanted for purposes that are not only innocent but useful, and restrictions can't be imposed in one case without operating also in the other. Again, public authority is entitled to guard against accidents. If a public officer, or anyone else, saw a person starting to cross a bridge known to be unsafe, and there was no time to warn him of his danger, they might seize him and pull him back, without any real infringement of his liberty. For liberty consists in doing what one desires, and he doesn't desire to fall into the river. Nevertheless, when there is a risk, but not a certainty of trouble, only the person himself can judge whether, in this case, he has a strong enough motive to make it worthwhile to run the risk. So I think he ought only to be warned of the danger, not forcibly prevented from exposing himself to it. This doesn't apply if he is a child, or delirious, or in some state of excitement or preoccupation that won't let him think carefully. Similar considerations apply to questions such as the sale of poisons, may enable us to decide which possible kinds of regulation are contrary to principle, and which are not. For example, a precaution such as labelling the drug with some warning of its dangerous character can be enforced without violation of liberty. The buyer can't want not to know that the stuff he has bought has poisonous qualities, but to require that in all such cases a doctor's prescription be produced would make it sometimes impossible, and always expensive, to obtain the article for legitimate uses. The only way that I can see of hindering crime committed through poison without significantly infringing on the liberty of those who want the poisonous substance for other purposes is something like the following. In the sale of articles that could be used as instruments of crime, the seller might be required to enter in a register the exact time of the sale, the name and address of the buyer, and the precise quality and quantity sold, to ask what it was wanted for, and to record the answer he received. And when there was no medical prescription, the presence of some third person might be required to make the purchaser fully aware of what he was buying, in case there later came to be evidence that it had been used for criminal purposes. Such regulations wouldn't make it much harder to obtain the poison, but would make it much harder to use it improperly without detection. This suggests the obvious limitations to the maxim that purely self-regarding misconduct should not be meddled with in the way of prevention or punishment. For example, drunkenness isn't a fit subject for legislative interference. But if someone had once been convicted of an act of violence to others under the influence of drink, I think it legitimate that he should be placed under a special legal restriction, personal to himself, that if he were ever again found drunk, he would be liable to a penalty, and that if, when drunk, he committed another offence, that punishment should be increased in severity. If drunkenness excites a person to harm others, making himself drunk is a crime against others. Another example: if an idle person isn't receiving support from the public or breaking a contract, it would be tyranny for him to be legally punished for his idleness. But if he is failing to perform his legal duties to others, as for instance to support his children, it is not tyrannical to force him to fulfil that obligation, by forced labour if no other means are available. This applies whether the source of the trouble is his idleness or some other avoidable cause. There is another question to which we need an answer consistent with the principles I have laid down. Take some case of personal conduct that is generally considered blameworthy, but which respect for liberty prevents society from preventing or punishing, because the harm directly resulting from it falls wholly on the person himself. The question is, if the agent is free to act like that, ought others to be equally free to advise or encourage him to do so? This question isn't entirely easy. When someone invites someone else to act in a certain way, we can't say that what the inviter is doing is strictly his own business. Advising or inducing someone is a social act, so we might think that it, like actions in general that affect others, is amenable to social control. But a little reflection corrects the first impression by showing that even though the case doesn't fall strictly within the definition of individual liberty, it does fall within the scope of the reasons for the principle of individual liberty. Here is how. If people must be allowed, in whatever concerns only themselves, to act however they choose at their own peril, they must equally be free to consult with one another about what should be done, to exchange opinions, and give and receive suggestions. Whatever it is permitted to do, it must be permitted to advise to do. The question is doubtful. Only when the adviser gets a personal benefit from his advice, when he makes his living out of promoting what society and the state consider to be an evil. That introduces a new element of complication, namely, the existence of classes of people whose interests are opposed to what is considered as the public good, and whose way of living is based on counteracting that good. Ought this to be interfered with or not? For example, fornication, sexual intercourse outside marriage, must be tolerated, and so must gambling. But should a person be free to be a pimp or to keep a gambling house? The case is one of those that lie on the exact boundary between two principles, and it isn't immediately clear which of the two it properly belongs to. There are arguments on both sides. On the side of toleration, this may be said: following something as an occupation and living or profiting by the practice of it can't make criminal something that would otherwise be admissible. The act should either be consistently permitted or consistently prohibited. If the principles that we have been defending are true, society, as such, has no business declaring wrong anything that concerns only the individual. It can't go beyond dissuasion, and one person should be as free to persuade as another to dissuade. In opposition to this, it may be contended that, although the public or the state are not entitled to lay it down authoritatively, for purposes of repression or punishment, that a given kind of conduct affecting only the interests of the individual is bad, if they do regard it as bad, they are fully justified in assuming that there is at least an open question about whether it is bad or not. Given just this very minimal assumption, they can't be acting wrongly in trying to exclude the influence of instigators who can't possibly be impartial, ones with a direct personal interest on one side, the side the state believes to be wrong, and who admit that they have purely personal motives for promoting it. Surely nothing can be lost, no good can be sacrificed, by arranging things in such a way that individuals make their choice, whether wisely or foolishly, on their own initiative, as free as possible from the wiles of people who want to influence them, for self-interested purposes of their own. Thus, although the present laws about gambling are utterly indefensible, and all people should be free to gamble in their own or each other's houses, or in any place of meeting established by their own subscriptions, and open only to the members and their visitors, nevertheless, public gambling-houses shouldn't be permitted. It is true that the prohibition is never effective, and that however much tyrannical power is given to the police, gambling-houses can always be maintained under other pretences. But still they may be compelled to conduct their operations with a certain degree of secrecy and mystery, so that nobody knows anything about them but those who seek them. That is as much as society should aim for. There is considerable force in these arguments. I shan't venture to decide whether they are sufficient to justify the oddity of punishing the accessory to an act when the agent himself goes free, of fining or imprisoning the pimp, but not the prostitute or her client, the gambling housekeeper, but not the gambler. Still less should ordinary buying and selling be interfered with on analogous grounds. Almost every article bought or sold could be used in excess, and the sellers have a financial interest in encouraging that excess. But no argument can be based on this in favour of, for instance, the main law against alcohol, because the class of dealers in strong drinks, though they have a financial interest in their products being misused, are indispensably required for the sake of their legitimate use. However, the motivation these dealers have for promoting excessive use of alcohol is a real evil, and it justifies the state in imposing restrictions and requiring guarantees, ones that would be infringements of legitimate liberty if it weren't for that justification. A further question. When the state regards certain conduct as contrary to the best interests of the agent, should it, without forbidding that conduct, nevertheless discourage it? For example, should the state take measures to make the means of drunkenness more costly, or make them harder to get, by limiting the number of places where they are sold? On this, as on most other practical questions, many distinctions need to be made. To tax stimulants solely so as to make them harder to obtain is a measure differing only in degree from prohibiting them entirely, and it would be justifiable only if prohibition were justifiable. Every increase of cost is a prohibition to those who can't afford the newly raised price, and to those who can afford it, the increase is a penalty inflicted on them for gratifying a particular taste. Their choice of pleasures, and how they spend their income, after satisfying their legal and moral obligations to the state and to individuals, are their own concern, and must be left to their own judgment. These considerations may seem at first sight to condemn the selection of alcohol as a special subject of taxation for revenue purposes, but it must be remembered that taxation for fiscal purposes is absolutely inevitable, that in most countries a considerable part of that taxation has to be indirect, and therefore that the state can't help imposing penalties on the use of some articles of consumption, penalties that may prevent some people from buying such articles. So the state has a duty to consider, in the imposition of taxes, what commodities the consumers can best spare, and that points very clearly to commodities that it thinks are positively harmful, except when used in very moderate quantities. Something that will harm people is certainly something they can spare. So taxation of stimulants, up to the point that produces the largest amount of needed revenue, is not only admissible, but to be approved of. How exclusive a privilege should the sale of these commodities be? The answer depends on what purposes the restriction is intended to serve. All places where the public gather require the restraint of enforceable rules governing how they are run, and this is especially true of drinking places, because that is where offences against society are apt to originate. So it is appropriate to confine the power of selling alcoholic drinks, at least for consumption on the spot, to persons of known or vouched-for respectability of conduct, to make whatever regulations about hours of opening and closing are needed for public surveillance, and to withdraw the license if breaches of the peace repeatedly take place through the connivance or incapacity of the keeper of the drinking-house, or if it becomes a rendezvous for thinking up and planning offences against the law. I can't think of any further restriction that would be in principle justifiable. What about limiting the number of beer and spirit-houses, so as to make them harder to get to, thus reducing the occasions of temptation? No. Not only does that expose all to an inconvenience, because there are some who would make bad use of easily found drinking-houses, but also it is suited only to a state of society in which the labouring classes are openly treated as children or savages, and placed under a discipline of restraint, like that of a child, to fit them for future admission to the privileges of freedom. This is not the principle on which the labouring classes are said to be governed in any free country, and no one who properly values freedom will assent to their being so governed, unless all efforts have been exhausted to educate them for freedom and govern them as free men, and it has been definitely proved that they can only be governed as children. No such efforts have been made. In any case, that needs to be considered here. The institutions of this country are a mass of inconsistencies, so that on one hand we admit into our practice restraints that belong to the system of despotic government, while on the other hand the general freedom of our institutions prevents us from exerting the amount of control needed to make the restraints really effective as moral education. And so we get the worst of both worlds, so to speak. The liberty of the individual, in matters that concern him alone, implies a corresponding liberty for any number of individuals to agree on regulations for matters that involve them jointly and don't involve anyone else. There is no problem about this, so long as the will of all the people in question remains unaltered. But since that will may change, it is often necessary, even when no one else is affected, that they should enter into engagements with one another. And when they do, it is generally good that those engagements be kept. Yet probably every country has laws creating some exceptions to this general rule. People are not held to engagements that violate the rights of third parties, but also it is sometimes considered a sufficient reason for releasing them from an engagement that it is harmful to themselves. In this and most other civilized countries, for example, an engagement by which a person sells himself, or allows himself to be sold, as a slave, would be null and void, not enforced by law or by public opinion. The ground for thus limiting his power of voluntarily disposing of his own course of life is obvious, and is very clearly seen in this extreme case. The reason for not interfering with a person's voluntary acts, except for the sake of others, is consideration for his liberty. His voluntary choice is evidence that what he so chooses is desirable to him, or at least endurable by him, and his good is on the whole best provided for by allowing him to pursue it in his own way. But by selling himself as a slave, he abdicates his liberty. He foregoes any future use of it after that single act. He therefore defeats the very purpose that is the justification for allowing him to dispose of himself. From now on, he won't be free. The principle of freedom can't require that he should be free, not to be free. Being allowed to give up his freedom is not freedom. Baron Wilhelm von Humboldt, in the excellent essay from which I have already quoted, holds that engagements involving personal relations or services should never be legally binding beyond a certain time limit, and that the most important of these engagements, marriage, the objectives of which are defeated, unless the feelings of both the parties are in harmony with it, should require nothing more than the declared wish of either party to dissolve it. This subject is too important and too complicated to be discussed in an aside, and I touch on it only so far as I need it for purposes of illustration. In the essay in question, Baron Humboldt aims to be brief and very general, so he had to settle for announcing his conclusion without discussing his reasons for it. If he had gone into the reasons, he would doubtless have recognised that the question can't be settled on grounds as simple as those to which he confines himself. When a person, either by explicit promise or by conduct, has encouraged someone else to rely on his continuing to act in a certain way, to build expectations and plans, and to stake any part of his plan of life on that supposition, a new series of moral obligations arises on his part towards that person. They may possibly be overruled, but they can't be ignored. Again, if the relation between two contracting parties has had consequences for others, if it has placed third parties in any special position, or even, as in the case of marriage, has brought third parties into existence, then both the contracting parties acquire obligations towards those third persons. And the choice of whether to maintain the original contract must have a great effect on whether, or at least on how, those obligations are fulfilled. It doesn't follow, and I don't believe, that these obligations extend to requiring the fulfilment of the contract at all costs to the happiness of the reluctant party, but they are a necessary element in the question. And even if, as von Humboldt maintains, they ought not to affect the party's legal freedom to release themselves from the engagement, and I also hold that they oughtn't to affect it much, they necessarily make a great difference to the party's moral freedom. A person is morally bound to take all these circumstances into account before deciding on a step that may affect such important interests of others. And if he doesn't allow proper weight to those interests, he is morally responsible for the wrong he does to the third parties. I have made these obvious remarks as an aid to illustrating the general principle of liberty, and not because they are at all needed on the particular question of divorce. So far from people needing reminders about obligations to third parties, discussions of divorce are usually handled as though the interests of children were everything, and those of adults were nothing. Now think about education. Isn't it almost self-evident that the state should require and compel the education, up to a certain standard, of everyone who is born its citizen? Yet isn't almost everyone afraid to recognize and assert this truth? Hardly anyone will deny that it is one of the most sacred duties of the parents, or, as law and usage now stand, the father, after bringing a human being into the world, to give to that being an education, fitting him to act well in life towards others and towards himself. But while this is unanimously declared to be the father's duty, hardly anyone in this country will listen to the suggestion that he should be obliged to perform it. Instead of his being required to make any exertion or sacrifice for securing education to the child, it is left to his choice to accept it or not, even when it is provided at no cost to himself. It still isn't generally recognized that to bring a child into existence without a good chance of being able to provide food for its body and training for its mind is a moral crime, both against the unfortunate offspring and against society, and that if the parent doesn't fulfill this obligation, the state ought to ensure that it is fulfilled, with the costs falling on the parent as much as possible. If the government's duty to enforce universal education were once admitted, that would put an end to the difficulties about what the state should teach and how it should teach. These difficulties now convert the subject into a mere battlefield for sects and parties, causing the time and labour that should have been spent on educating to be wasted in quarrelling about education. If the government made up its mind to require a good education for every child, it could save itself the trouble of providing one. It could leave it up to parents to obtain the education where and how they pleased, and restrict its own involvement to helping to pay the school fees of the poorer children. The reasonable objections that are brought against state education don't apply to the enforcement of education by the state. Their target is the state's taking on itself the task of directing that education, which is a totally different thing. No one objects more strongly than I do to the states being in charge of any large part of the education of the people. Everything I have said about the importance of individuality of character and variety in opinions and ways of life applies also to variety in education, which is equally important. A general state education is a mere contrivance for moulding people to be exactly like one another, and the mould in which it casts them is the one that pleases the predominant power in the government, whether this is a monarchy, a priesthood, an aristocracy, or a democratic majority. In so far as it is efficient and successful in its aim, it, to that extent, establishes a despotism over the mind, which naturally leads to despotism over the body. If there is to be any education established and controlled by the state, it should be merely one among many competing experiments, carried on for the purpose of example and stimulus, to keep the others up to a certain standard of excellence. An exception to this is created when a society in general is in such a backward condition that it can't or won't provide for itself any proper institutions of education, unless the government takes on the task. In that case, indeed, the government may accept for itself, as the lesser of two great evils, the business of schools and universities, just as it may take on the running of joint stock companies in a country with no system of private enterprise, adequate for undertaking great works of industry. But in general, if a country contains enough people qualified to provide education under government auspices, those same people would be able and willing to give an equally good education at private schools, given the assurance of payment that would be provided by a law making education compulsory, together with state aid to those unable to pay for themselves. How could such a law be enforced? It would have to be through public examinations, extending to all children and beginning at an early age. An age might be fixed at which every child must be examined to discover whether he or she could read. A child who turns out to be unable to read might be sent to school at the father's expense, unless the father had some sufficient ground of excuse, and the father might also be subjected to a moderate fine, which he could, if necessary, pay by working it off. The examination should be renewed annually, with a gradually extending range of subjects, so as to make it virtually compulsory for everyone to have and retain a certain minimum of general knowledge. Beyond that minimum, there should be voluntary examinations on all subjects, at which all who reach a certain standard of proficiency might claim a certificate. To prevent the state from using these arrangements to influence opinion improperly, the knowledge required for passing an examination should, even in the more advanced examinations, be strictly confined to facts and science, and of course the merely instrumental parts of knowledge, such as languages and their use. The examinations on religion, politics, or other controversial topics should depend not on the truth or falsehood of opinions about those topics, but on matters of fact, that such and such an opinion is held on such and such grounds, by such and such authors, or schools, or churches. Under this system, the coming generation would be no worse off in regard to all controversial truths than at present. They would be brought up as churchmen, or dissenters, as they are now, the state merely taking care that they should be informed churchmen or informed dissenters. There would be nothing to hinder them from being taught religion, if their parents so chose, at the same schools where they were taught other things. All attempts by the state to bias the conclusions of its citizens on controversial subjects are evil, but the state may very properly offer to discover and certify that a person possesses the knowledge needed to make his conclusions, on any given subject, worth attending to. A student of philosophy would be the better for being able to pass an examination on both Locke and Kant, whichever of the two he takes up with, and even if he doesn't take up with either. And there is no reasonable objection to examining an atheist on the case for Christianity, provided he isn't required to proclaim that he accepts it. But I think that the examinations in the higher branches of knowledge should be entirely voluntary. It would give too dangerous a power to governments if they were allowed to exclude anyone from professions, even from the profession of teacher, for allegedly not being qualified. I agree with Wilhelm von Humboldt that university degrees or other public certificates of scientific or professional acquirements should be given to all who present themselves for examination and pass the test. but that such certificates should give them no advantage over competitors apart from their effect on public opinion. It is not only in the matter of education that misplaced notions of liberty prevent the moral obligations of parents from being recognized, and legal obligations on them from being imposed, in matters where there are always the strongest grounds for the former, and in many cases for the latter also. To undertake the responsibility of causing the existence of a human being is a crime against the offspring, unless he or she will have at least the ordinary chances of a desirable existence. And in a country that is overpopulated, or threatened with being so, to produce more than a tiny number of children is a serious offence against all who live by the wages they earn, because every new child threatens wage levels by adding to the competition for work. The laws which in many countries on the European continent forbid marriage, unless the parties can show that they have the means of supporting a family, don't exceed the legitimate powers of the state. And whether or not such laws really are advisable, which mainly depends on local circumstances and feelings, they are not objectionable as violations of liberty. Such laws are interferences by the state to prohibit a bad act, an act injurious to others, which ought to bring criticism and social stigma, even when it isn't thought advisable to add legal punishment. Yet the current ideas of liberty, which bend so easily to real infringements of the freedom of the individual, in matters that concern only himself, would repel any attempt to restrain his inclinations, when they will otherwise lead to lives of wretchedness and depravity for his offspring, with many evils to others close enough to feel the effects of how the offspring act. When we compare the strange respect of mankind for liberty with their strange lack of respect for it, we might imagine that a man had an indispensable right to do harm to others, and no right at all to please himself without doing harm to anyone. I have saved up till the last a large class of questions about the limits of government interference that don't strictly belong to the subject of this essay, but are closely connected with it. These questions arise when the reasons against interference don't turn on the principle of liberty. The question is not about restraining the actions of individuals, but about helping them. It is asked whether the government should do, or cause to be done, something for their benefit, instead of leaving it to be done by themselves individually, or in voluntary groups. When government interference wouldn't involve any infringement of liberty, it may still be objected to on either of three grounds. The first is when the thing to be done is likely to be better done by individuals than by the government. Speaking generally, no one is as fit to conduct a business, or decide how or by whom it shall be conducted, as are those whose personal interests are involved. The second objection has more to do with our subject. In many cases, though individuals may not, on average, do the particular thing as well as the officers of government would, it is nevertheless desirable that it should be done by them as a means to their own mental education, a way of strengthening their active faculties, exercising their judgment, and familiarizing them with the matters in question. This is a chief reason for jury trials in cases that aren't political, for free and popular local and municipal institutions, for having industrial and philanthropic enterprises run by voluntary associations. These are questions not of liberty, but of development. They concern the special training of a citizen, the practical part of the political education of a free people, taking them out of the narrow circle of personal and family selfishness, getting them used to the wider view of joint interests, the management of joint concerns, habituating them to act from public motives, and guide their conduct by aims that unite rather than divide them. Without these habits and powers, a free constitution can neither be worked nor preserved, as is illustrated by the too often transitory nature of political freedom in countries where it isn't firmly enough based on local liberties. The management of purely local businesses by the localities, and of the great enterprises of industry by the union of those who voluntarily put up the money for them, is further recommended by all the advantages that I have presented, as belonging to individuality of development and variety in ways of acting. Government operations tend to be everywhere alike. With individuals and voluntary associations, on the other hand, there are varied experiments and endless diversity of experience. The state can usefully make itself a central depository of the experience, resulting from many trials, and actively circulate and diffuse knowledge about what that experience has shown. Its business is to enable each experimenter to benefit by the experiments of others, instead of tolerating no experiments but its own. The third, and most powerful reason for restricting the interference of government, is the great evil of adding unnecessarily to its power. Every function added to those already exercised by the government causes its influence over hopes and fears to be more widely diffused, and increasingly converts the active and ambitious part of the public into hangers-on of the government, or of some party that aims at becoming the government. If the roads, the railways, the banks, the insurance offices, the great joint stock companies, the universities, and the public charities were all branches of the government, if in addition the municipal corporations and local boards, with all that they do now, became departments of the central administration, and if the employees of all these different enterprises were appointed and paid by the government, and looked to the government for every promotion or pay increase, not all the freedom of the press and democratic constitution of the legislature would make any country free except in name. And the more efficiently and scientifically the administrative machinery was constructed, the more skilful the arrangements for obtaining the best qualified hands and heads with which to work it, the greater the harm it would do. In England, it has recently been proposed that all members of the government's civil service should be selected by competitive examination to obtain for those jobs the most intelligent and instructed persons that can be found. And much has been said and written for and against this proposal. One of the arguments most insisted on by its opponents is that a permanent official servant of the state doesn't have good enough prospects of salary and importance to attract the highest talents, which can always find a more inviting career in the professions or in the service of companies and other public bodies. It would not have been surprising if this argument had been used by the friends of the proposition as an answer to its principal difficulty. It is certainly strange, coming from the opponents. What is urged as an objection is really the safety valve of the proposed system. If indeed all the high talent of the country could be drawn into the service of the government, a proposal tending to bring about that result might well cause uneasiness. If every part of the business of society that required organized cooperation or large and comprehensive views were in the hands of the government, and if government posts were always filled by the ablest men, almost all the enlarged culture and practiced intelligence in the country would be concentrated in a numerous bureaucracy, to whom alone the rest of the community would look for all things, the mass of people for direction and dictation in all they had to do, able and inspiring people for personal advancement. The sole objects of ambition would be admission into the ranks of this bureaucracy, and promotion in it. Under this regime, government that badly needs changing will not be changed. The outside public doesn't have the practical experience it needs to be qualified to criticize or check the workings of the bureaucracy. And even if the accidents of despotism, or the natural working of democratic institutions, occasionally bring to the top a ruler or rulers who want to reform the government, no reform can be carried out that is contrary to the interests of the bureaucracy. That is the sad condition of the Russian Empire, as is shown in the accounts of those who have been able to observe it. The Tsar himself is powerless against the bureaucratic body. He can send any one of them to Siberia, but he can't govern without them or against their will. On every decree of his, they have a tacit veto, which they can exercise by merely not carrying the decree into effect. In countries of more advanced civilization and of a more revolutionary spirit, the public, accustomed to expect everything to be done for them by the state, or at least to do nothing for themselves without asking the state, not only for permission to do it, but even how it is to be done, naturally hold the state responsible for everything bad that happens to them. And when things become worse than they are willing to put up with, they rise against the government and make what is called a revolution. Whereupon somebody else, with or without legitimate authority from the nation, leaps into the seat of power, issues his orders to the bureaucracy, and everything goes on much as it did before, the bureaucracy being unchanged, and nobody else being capable of taking their place. A very different scene appears among a people accustomed to transact their own business. In France, a large part of the people have been engaged in military service, many having held at least the rank of non-commissioned officers. So in every popular uprising, there are several persons competent to take the lead and improvise some reasonable plan of action. What the French are in military affairs, the Americans are in every kind of civil business. Leave them without a government, and every group of Americans is able to improvise one, and to carry it on with enough intelligence, order, and decision. This is what every free people ought to be, and a people capable of this is certain to be free. It will never let itself be enslaved by any man or group who can take control, only because they are able to seize and pull the reins of the central administration. No bureaucracy can hope to make people like this do or undergo anything they don't like. But where everything is done through the bureaucracy, nothing can be done that the bureaucracy is really opposed to. The governmental structure of such countries is an organization of the experience and practical ability of the nation into a disciplined body for the purpose of governing the rest. And the more perfect that organization is in itself, the more successful in drawing to itself and educating for its own purposes the ablest people from all ranks of the community, the more complete is the bondage of everyone, including the members of the bureaucracy. For the governors are as much the slaves of their organization and discipline as the governed are slaves of the governors. A Chinese mandarin is as much the tool and creature of a despotism as the humblest peasant. An individual Jesuit is to the utmost degree of abasement the slave of his order, the Society of Jesus, although the order itself exists for the collective power and importance of its members. It should also be borne in mind that the absorption of all the principal ability of the country into the governing body is fatal, sooner or later, to the mental activity and progressiveness of the governing body itself. Its members are banded together, working a system which, like all systems, has to proceed to a large extent by fixed rules, and this puts them under the constant temptation of sinking into lazy routine. And if they occasionally break away from that routine, they are tempted to rush into some half-examined crudity that has struck the fancy of some leading member of the corps. And the only guard against these tendencies, the only stimulus that can keep the ability of the governing body itself up to a high standard, is its being open to the watchful criticism of equally able people outside the body. So it is indispensable that there should be some way, independently of the government, of having such able people, and giving them the opportunities and experience needed for judgment in great practical affairs. So, we have on one side the evils in over-large government, evils that are so formidable to human freedom and advancement, and on the other side, the benefits that come from the collective application of the force of society, under its recognized leaders, for removing obstacles to its well-being. This gives us a question of balance, the question of how to secure as much of the advantages of centralized power and intelligence as possible, without handing over to the government too great a proportion of the society's activity. In brief, at what point do the evils start to predominate over the benefits? This is one of the most difficult and complicated questions in the business of government. It is largely a question of detail, but I believe that the practical principle needed for us to stay safe can be expressed thus. The greatest dissemination of power, consistent with efficiency, and the greatest possible centralization of information and diffusion of it from the center. Applying the former of these would give a result like that in the New England states. All business that wouldn't be better left to the individuals directly concerned would be distributed amongst many public officials, chosen by the localities. And, applying the second of the two rules of thumb, each branch of local affairs would be superintended centrally by a branch of the general government. And the superintending body would act like a lens, concentrating the variety of information and experience derived from the conduct of that branch of public business in all the localities, from everything analogous that is done in foreign countries, and from the general principles of political science. This central organization should have a right to know all that is done, and a special duty to make the knowledge acquired in one place available for others. Freed by its elevated position and wide sphere of observation from the petty prejudices and narrow views of a locality, its advice would naturally carry much authority, but its actual power as a permanent institution should, in my view, be limited to compelling the local officers to obey the laws laid down for their guidance. In everything not provided for by general rules, those officers should be left to their own judgment and a responsibility to their constituents. End of chapter 5. End of the work.